Welcome to DAC Beechcroft's NHS Estates podcast series. My name's Emma Thompson and I'm an associate in the real estate team here at DAC Beechcroft, specialising in health. And I'm joined today by Alex Faye Grundy, who's also an associate in our healthcare real estate team.
Hi Emma, and welcome to everybody who is tuning into our NHS Estates podcast series. Before we get started, this is episode 4 in the NHS Estates series, and previous episodes can be found on our Lawcast channel on all the usual podcast providers. So today we're going to talk about NHS specific points which should be included in a lease where one party is an NHS body. Our focus will be on the key practical points that NHS bodies should bear in mind when they are negotiating leases at the heads of term stage, where the NHS is either a landlord or a tenant. It's really key to introduce any NHS specific provisions as early as possible, as we often find that non-NHS bodies and their advisors might not necessarily be aware of these provisions, which essentially provide the NHS with sufficient flexibility to ensure that it can operate effectively and collaboratively and to deliver its services in accordance with the NHS commitments and guidance.
That's right, Alex. When we are acting for NHS trusts as landlords or tenants, we're often involved in negotiations which can become quite protracted because of the requirements of the NHS can be seen as alien concepts to other parties. So it's important at the outset of any transaction to make these specific points clear when negotiating, ideally flagging them at heads of term stage. So let's get started with our first topic, which is the NHS exemption provisions. We always try and include these within our NHS leases, and we can tailor them depending on whether we are acting for the NHS body as a landlord or a tenant.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Emma. Could you perhaps give us some examples here?
Yes, of course. So most of these apply where the NHS trust is a tenant and permits certain privileges, for want of a better word, due to the strong covenant nature that the tenant will have as an NHS body. They are, in effect, backed by the Treasury. A number of them are also recommended as best practice by the Estates Code 2, which is, I'm sure, is a document that everyone who is listening to is aware of. Some are related to operational aspects, giving an extra layer of security and control, for example, where the landlord wants to exercise rights of entry to an area let to a tenant. We want to ensure that they have to comply with the tenant's security requirements. This is vital as there can be medical records, specialist equipment, confidential information being held in these premises. And if patients are being treated there, there could be patients there. So it's important to consider patient safety and dignity issues here as well. It also works the other way. A landlord of a hospital will want control over the tenant's use of common areas for similar reasons and ensure that the tenant strictly complies with all regulations relating to the use of a hospital and be permitted to take urgent action to close certain areas where required for clinical purposes. This can sometimes be challenging when dealing with a commercial tenant in a hospital, for example, in a retail concourse, as they are used to having more control over the operations of their units. But it's important to ensure that the hospital has control to enable it to make the decisions to preserve the safety and continuity of patient care, which is obviously absolutely vital and the point of the hospital premises. We can talk a little bit more about controls needed over goods sold at NHS sites a little bit later on in the podcast, Alex.
Thanks, Emma. I often find specific provisions are required to link occupation in with any service contracts or other commercial contracts. Do you find that is also the case?
Yes, exactly. It's very important. And the links in with the tenant's right to deal with the lease and the property in a flexible way, and also the circumstances in which the lease may be terminated. Like, for example, an NHS body, it's important that they can assign or underlet or share occupation of whole of the premises with another NHS body without consent from the landlord, and that they can share with other bodies providing ancillary services, for example, to what the tenant is doing there without the consent of the landlord.
Yes, this is something that we see frequently, especially in our lease negotiations, and it is particularly relevant given the emphasis here on collaboration, particularly with healthcare bodies sharing space and collaborating with one another to provide these healthcare services. For example, if a property is required in connection with the delivery of a specific service, it is important to be mindful here that the service contract may allow the service to be reallocated to an alternative provider. And in this instance, the lease will need to allow an NHS tenant to assign a lease or perhaps sublet the lease to another NHS body without the consent of the landlord. And this is to ensure that the service can continue to be provided without any interruption. For example, you don't want the assignment or the subletting to be contingent on landlord's consent here, particularly if there is a delay, because this could, you know, indirectly affect the provision of the service. It's particularly important as well because we do often see that non-NHS landlords can be reluctant to accept this here because arguably, you know, it's their premises. They want to have control over who's occupying the property so that it can ensure that any incoming parties are able to pay the rents due under the lease or they're able to comply with the lease obligations contained in the lease on behalf of the tenant. So as Emma touched on before, the NHS has significant covenant strength when it's acting in its capacity as a tenant. This is because not only is it a public body, but it's also controlled by the Treasury. And so this argument is key really here to provide the NHS with the freedom from having to obtain landlord's consent, and so should be raised with non-NHS landlords at the forefront to provide them with that sufficient comfort that they might necessarily need, and something, you know, something which they might not come across in kind of their everyday commercial dealings. It's also really common that NHS trusts need to share occupation with numerous bodies providing ancillaries in respect of the delivery of that particular healthcare service. And this is because this is ingrained within the NHS objective of working collaboratively to ensure the effective delivery of services on the ground. And so, again, the lease should also include a right for the NHS to share occupation without landlord's consent where ancillary healthcare services are being provided. And in this instance, again, we shouldn't really be seeing any landlord or tenant relationship established here on the basis that because the third party is simply sharing occupation, there isn't usually a situation where rents are being exchanged. And so again, that argument can be used in order to try to get this provision included within the lease, as it is a standard sharing occupation provision. And so we often see that then is accepted by landlords, particularly sometimes commercial landlords. And finally, in terms of key points regarding service contracts, the lease should and must really allow either the landlord or the tenant to terminate the lease if the service contract ends. Typically, we do see an automatic termination provision within leases. So, for example, if the NHS service contract ends and the particular NHS body can no longer provide the service, that should then automatically trigger termination of the lease. This is really important because essentially the NHS want to avoid being on the hook for any rents for properties that it cannot provide services from. Also, it's really important for an NHS landlord to include an automatic termination provision, because essentially if you have a property from which healthcare services are being provided and the tenant service contract terminates and so cannot provide those services, you want to make sure that you have sufficient flexibility within your estate to allow other prospective tenants to enter into a lease so that those services can be provided with as little disruption as possible. And so that's really a really, really key point. Another thing we also see is a provision within the lease which allows either party to serve notice, particularly an NHS tenant, where it anticipates that the service contract won't be renewed. And this is to essentially put the landlord on notice that the lease is therefore going to come to an end, and allows, again, both parties to effectively manage their estates in light of the service contract terminating.
Thanks, Alex. Another key concession that springs to my mind is that on the assignment of a lease by an NHS body, it can't be required to act as a guarantor for a person or a body it is assigning to. So that's what we call an authorised guarantee agreement, or an ARGA, if you hear that acronym used. And if such assignee is an NHS body, then that NHS body should not be obliged to provide a guarantor for itself. And that's a very important point that I think should be stressed there.
Yes, definitely, Emma. I think, you know, that is an essential addition, particularly because the estate code does require that any provisions requiring NHS bodies to give guarantees should be resisted. And I think it's quite useful to understand the background and the reasoning for this, which is essentially that the NHS don't want to remain on the hook for any unpaid sums or any breaches of covenant under the lease which have been carried out by a third party. And this is because the monies are essentially coming from the public purse, of which, you know, given budgetary constraints, etc., the monies should be prioritised for, again, the delivery of healthcare services. And there is, and again, there is increased emphasis here on collaboration with any other NHS bodies, including the shared use of spaces with third parties providing the ancillary services, etc. And so here, where there is an assignment, for example, the NHS should be pushing back in its own individual capacity on the basis that the incoming party will be liable, will take their own responsibility here in terms of becoming liable, and essentially for the provisions to meet the estate code requirements. So, Emma, in terms of these kind of key essentials, what do you consider to be the best way of getting these concessions agreed? Apart from using specialist NHS lawyers who, you know, have a good understanding of these points.
Well, as we all know, negotiations should start with a robust set of heads of terms. These will be non-binding, but will set out the main commercial aspects of the proposed lease. And as the NHS exemption provisions are niche to health transactions, it's extremely useful to have these points discussed with the other side at heads of terms stage. Whilst I have mentioned that they're not legally binding, departure from agreed heads of terms is largely frowned upon. And it's also imperative that such bespoke elements are discussed at this stage. We always recommend to clients that we have legal input into the heads of terms so that we can share our drafting with the other side and they can get comfortable with what's being proposed up front. From a commercial point of view, it's also important to stress that the provisions are only relevant where a tenant is an NHS body. So if the lease is assigned by the NHS body to a commercial entity, these provisions have no impact. And sometimes landlords can be quite hesitant to consent to the inclusion of these kind of provisions because they're worried about this point. But it really shouldn't be a reason for why the landlord refuses the drafting within the lease, particularly as the NHS is a multidiscipline service requiring collaboration for the effective delivery of its services to the public.
Thanks, Emma. Yeah, I think that's really, really useful. And it does show how the drafting in the lease is imperative to ensure NHS bodies can deliver their services effectively and to ensure that they can essentially meet their aims as a healthcare provider.
So let's move on to another NHS specific provision. This one relates to insurance and it's called the PES scheme. Alex, we use the PES acronym all the time, but can you tell us what PES actually stands for?
Of course, Emma. So the PES stands for Property Expenses Scheme, and it's a scheme that's administered on behalf of the Secretary of State for Health and Social Care, and it's run by NHS Resolution.
And what does the scheme actually cover?
So the scheme deals with property damage and covers certain losses for material damage to buildings, including contents, from various causes such as fire, theft, water damage and business interruption cover. The scheme is regulated by the National Health Service Property Expenses Scheme Amendment Regulations 2014. And these regulations set out the rules for membership, which all members must sign up to. It's a complex scheme and there are various limits and conditions, though this podcast won't cover any specific detail regarding those limits and conditions.
And how would we as lawyers reference the PES within a lease?
Yes, so it's imperative for any NHS body who is a landlord to include the option to insure the property via the PES scheme and to reserve the right to use top-up insurance where, for instance, the PES scheme won't cover the full extent of the damage. The insurance clause should therefore operate to give the NHS landlord full control as to how they wish to insure the property or the building that's subject to the lease.
Thanks, Alex. So whilst this is an NHS specific provision, it's necessary that NHS landlords reserve this right under the lease. You're talking about top-up insurance as well. Where would this be relevant?
So the Estate Code confirms that the PES scheme does not provide reimbursement for significant property damage, and maximum limits will apply here depending on the NHS organisation's size and turnover. So estate code, for example, uses the instance where a hospital is seriously damaged by fire and has to be demolished and rebuilt. The estate code here expressly confirms that the PES scheme would not cover all of that cost. So we often come across a discussion about top-up insurance here when the trust is entering into leases for, you know, commercial uses, for example, retail concourse developments. And so it's really important to flag that this top-up insurance option is crucial here to allow the NHS to ensure that it has got sufficient insurance in place should there be any significant property damage. I also think it's worth touching briefly on the position here where an NHS body is a tenant under a lease and the landlord is also an NHS body, because the position differs slightly here. If you're the tenant under the lease, in an ideal world, you wouldn't be picking up any excess if the landlord opted to insure via the PES scheme. And this is because the PES scheme does require a substantial excess. So if you're the landlord, you would ideally include a provision to state that the tenant will meet any additional premium cost incurred by you in obtaining any top-up insurance to ensure that sufficient contributions are made where other alternative top-up means are required because of the limitations of PES.
So from a practical and transactional point of view, I find that unless the other side has experience of NHS matters, then the PES scheme, understandably, it isn't correctly understood. Is that something that you've also experienced, Alex?
Yes, definitely. And I think, again, my practical advice here circles back to the advantages of explaining this at the heads of term stage. The PES scheme is a complex scheme and it's not widely known about. So, you know, likelihood is that if you are dealing with commercial entities, they might not be familiar with this concept. And so if you invest the time in kind of discussing this at the outset, this will save time and legal costs if the other side are fully comfortable and fully understand these elements right at the outset of the matter.
Thanks, Alex. Now, moving on to sustainability, which has become an increasingly talked about topic of conversation in all aspects of our lives. With pressure mounting on public bodies to become more sustainable in their practices, it's useful to know that there are specific NHS sustainability provisions that can be included within leases.
Yes, so our colleague Lisa Geary chaired a really helpful webinar back in the summer, which discussed in considerable detail the NHS commitment to reaching carbon zero. I think it's really useful to outline some key points here. So the first point of call for considering the appropriate clauses to be included in an NHS lease should be the NHS Green Lease Toolkit. This is available on NHS England's website, and we recommend that all estates personnel review this really helpful toolkit.
Exactly. One thing to consider at the heads of term stage is to ask the landlord whether they have got any sustainability provisions of their own, which you can consider for inclusion in the lease. If they don't, then you should be asking them to consider whether they'll sign up to the inclusion of the standard NHS sustainability provisions within the lease. There are some green clauses which can be added as a schedule to any lease, and it's important to the NHS that their suppliers, in cases of leases, we're talking about landlords, that they're working in partnership with the NHS to deal with climate change, and suppliers should be wise to see that this is a good opportunity to improve their own green credentials. It can be a trickier sell to get the other side to sign up when you're dealing with a lease renewal rather than a new lease, but it needs to be appreciated across the board that this is a clear aim of the NHS going forward, to build a greener, more sustainable NHS for all, and that these provisions are actually legitimate, and I put this in quotation marks, updating provisions.
I agree, Emma, and I think, you know, in practice, that's something that I find quite often, is that particularly where you do have a lease renewal on the same terms, there can sometimes be pushback in relation to these provisions. But I think it's key to, you know, really emphasise that, you know, in terms of the NHS commitments going forward, the NHS do want to commit to have a, the NHS do have a clear commitment to reducing and to becoming carbon zero, and that essentially these provisions do benefit all, particularly as these healthcare services are, you know, being rolled out into the community. So one thing that we do come across within the NHS Green Lease Toolkit is the distinction between light green provisions and dark green provisions. Are you, Emma, able to provide more details on these different provisions and what they mean for NHS bodies?
Yes. So light green provisions, they help towards reaching carbon reduction targets. As a general rule, they tend not to have a monetary impact on parties. An example would be prohibiting a tenant from installing plant or equipment which would reduce the environmental performance of a building, for example, or requiring parties to collaborate with data sharing and discussing green strategies. Whereas dark green provisions are more onerous and there can be significant monetary impacts on the parties, such as a rent reduction if the landlord fails to meet energy reductions, or requiring monies to be spent in making improvements. The Estates Code requires that trusts do try to reduce their carbon emissions in all organisations and try to develop a sustainable strategy which they can all work towards.
Great, thanks Emma. Although we have touched really briefly on the NHS sustainability provisions, for anybody who would like any more information, please do contact us and we can supply you with a recording of that webinar that was ran by Lisa earlier in the year.
Okay, let's turn to something even more specific, the use of CEQIN provisions. CEQIN is the Commissioning for Quality and Innovation. And this is a framework which normally gets updated every year, and it supports improvements in quality and service and the creation of new and improved patterns of care. In 2016, guidance was issued relating to a focus being placed on making healthier food and drink sold at NHS premises more widely available. And this is to benefit both staff, patients, and visitors alike. It's also links in with a requirement under the Estates Code, which states that trusts should work with retailers to increase the range and visibility of healthy food options for customers and reduce the availability of unhealthy options. The Hospital Food Standard Panel also provides guidance to all NHS hospitals, and that they should have an organisational wide food and drink strategy.
Thanks, Emma. And when do we as lawyers make reference to the CEQIN guidance within the lease?
Yes, these provisions are used where the NHS client is a landlord and the tenant will be a retailer selling food and drink. The aim is to encourage collaborative working between the parties to ensure that a number of outcomes are met and that evidence can be called upon to show that, that these specific outcomes are actually being met. The main outcomes originally were set down in four areas, and they include banning price promotion, so you're kind of you buy one get one freeze on unhealthy items, advertising, sales at the checkout of high fat, salty, sugary, saturated products, as well as ensuring that healthy options are available for staff at night.
Thanks, Emma. And so in terms of in practice then, so how do we deal with this in a retail lease?
So we have at DAC Beechcroft some specific drafting, which we incorporate into leases, as I say, where the NHS body is the landlord, which requires retail tenants to work collaboratively towards sequent aims and do require that data is shared with the NHS body to show how these outcomes are being worked towards and achieved.
Thanks, Emma. Sometimes I find that we do get pushback from tenants on this who will sometimes claim that they can't provide the data. And so I think, again, you know, as we've said throughout this podcast, I think it's best to notify any retail tenant up front, particularly again at the heads of term stage of these requirements, because usually I find that this data can be provided through organisations, but that organisations may sometimes need additional time to locate the data. I also think it's really useful to notify a prospective tenant at the outset so that they can ensure that the objective is achievable at the point of completion. So, for example, if they need to put any kind of additional administrative mechanisms in place to ensure compliance, I think they sometimes might need that extra time or maybe work towards that in the background whilst the negotiations are ongoing in terms of at the legal stage. And whilst I appreciate that meeting CEQIN requirements might add additional administrative elements to the tenant, I think the key takeaway from the CEQIN point again is that this is a real focus on collaboration to encourage partnership between both NHS suppliers and partners and with NHS bodies themselves to create a healthy environment for us all. And I think whilst we're discussing what a retail client can sell on the NHS premises, I think it's also worth adding that it's important to exclude the sale of specific items, which sometimes don't align with the trust values, which, you know, are contrary to the nature of the services being provided. And I think common examples of those foods and items, which we see as a standard exclusion, would be alcohol, cigarettes, knives, for example. And I think often you can see that there is an extensive list of prohibited items in the lease.
Yes, that's really helpful to agree at the outset what items can and can't be sold from an NHS premises. So we're coming to the end of our podcast, and if we summarise, I think a theme that's run through all of the topics we've discussed today is that NHS bodies need to get all of these niche elements in at the heads of term stage. So often we see heads of terms don't contain these specific provisions, and then it can take a couple of rounds of negotiations to actually get them encouraged and for the explanations to be given to get them included.
Thanks, Emma. I agree. I think this can be particularly time consuming when we're dealing with solicitors on the other side who might not be used to transactions with NHS bodies or familiar with the concepts or the requirements. Here at DACB, we're more than happy to provide you with a short summary of the niche elements and the reasons why these need to be included when you are at the negotiation stage, so that this can help progress the commercials to allow for these provisions to be included within the heads of terms. As Emma said earlier, whilst heads of terms aren't necessarily binding, it can sometimes be frowned upon when negotiations tend to steer away from the heads of terms. And so I think for that reason, we would recommend that any NHS specific provisions are included in the heads of terms so that all parties are clear as to the lease requirements right at the outset. We at DACB generally take the standpoint that due to the covenant strength of NHS bodies, these niche elements should be included. And again, we can, you know, discuss with you any wording that you might require in order to provide the necessary comfort to the other side. For example, any landlord, commercial landlords, who aren't familiar with that concept, if they do need that explaining in a bit more further detail. We also tend to mention how many leases are linked to service level contracts here, which again can be taken over by other NHS bodies. And so NHS, you know, the focus here is that the NHS requires that flexibility to effectively deliver the services to the community. So it's really important for the landlord to understand here that the intra-assignment where the consent provisions will not apply is restricted to NHS bodies only. And so it won't apply to any private healthcare companies. In that case, the usual assignment provisions will operate. And so that should provide the landlord with the comfort that it should require to ensure that the assignment does, without consent, does only apply to NHS bodies.
So we're coming to the end of our podcast, and we hope you have found it informative on the niche elements of an NHS lease. And if you do have any follow-up queries, please do feel free to get in touch with me or Alex or any member of our extensive real estate health lawyers.
Thanks, Emma. It was really great chatting today. I think it's really, really useful to sit down sometimes just to discuss the key points that tend to come up at heads of term stage. And as Emma said, if anybody has got any questions, do feel free to get in touch with us. And just to thank everybody for their time in listening to this podcast. Thanks.